From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I'm interested in growing all manner of things, so one page of a new cookbook on sourdough baking that showed a glass jar of bubbling over sourdough starter caught my attention. It's alive, I thought, full of multiplying microbes that do good work in behalf of the baker and also for those who then eat the goods baked with it. Those of you who are regular listeners know I have a similar fascination with other forms of fermentation and culturing, like making homemade yogurt or lacto-fermented concoctions from fruits and garden vegetables, for instance. Along those lines, today, we're going to learn about sourdough and specifically about how to grow your own homemade sourdough starter from a few humble ingredients. No mail order packets of the stuff are used by today's guest, Sarah Owens, author of Sourdough, Rustic Recipes for Fermented Breads, Sweets, Savories, and More. Originally a professional ceramic artist, Sarah trained as a horticulturist at the New York Botanical Gardens School of Professional Horticulture. After graduation in 2009, she spent the next 6 years as the organic rosarian at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. In 2013, she founded BK17 Bakery as a way to bring real bread back to Brooklyn. So we'll hear more about all that. And I'm so glad to welcome Sarah to the program. How are you?
Thank you for having me today, Margaret.
Welcome. So you came to sourdough baking because of your own food intolerances. I read in your biography, I didn't know that, because the book doesn't look like anybody who's skipping anything. It's all so fabulous looking.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's true. I definitely at one time had some major sort of intolerances to a lot of different things, a lot of different grains besides just wheat.
Uh-huh.
And so the lacto-fermentation of sourdough really helped to mitigate those intolerances, as well as some other lifestyle changes that I had to make at the time as well.
Yeah, in the same way, I think that for some people who can't digest dairy so well, sometimes yogurt mm-hmm. that's been cultured for, say, 24 hours, long-cultured, slow-cultured yogurt can be digestible. It's interesting, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. The big difference between sourdough and something like yogurt is that the wonderful microbes do all the work for us before we bake the bread and sort of make it more digestible for us. It's almost like thinking about your culture or your starter as an extra stomach.
The pre-digester.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so it's very obvious in this new book, in the book Sourdough, by Sarah mm-hmm. Owens, it's very obvious that you're a gardener, not just a baker. And actually, I would say from the photographs that it's obvious that you have a background in ceramics. In a way, I can see your mm-hmm. three-dimensional design sense, too, but that's another story altogether. you can tell that you're a gardener because of many things, some of the ingredients you choose to incorporate into your recipes, but also there's even a page in the book about making compost tea. Now, tell us how that connects to sourdough, because obviously we're not putting it in our bread.
Oh, gosh, I hope not. So, if anybody does, let me know. That would be fascinating.
But it's interesting. You make this connection about, like, the food web, so to speak.
Correct. So it's really important to remember that a sourdough culture is something that's alive, and we're sort of nurturing these different microbes, both bacteria and other little critters that are running around in our culture of flour and water. And we're nurturing these things in order to help us be able to produce something beautiful and tasty. And in the world of gardening, we have to sort of remember that we aren't just growing plants. We are nurturing a microbiome in the soil that allows us to grow really beautiful, tasty, wonderful plants.
Right.
So
the
concepts are very similar.
Yeah. Well, it definitely comes through your appreciation for, again, that sort of almost invisible end of the food chain. It really comes
mm-hmm.
through. So sort of speaking of recipes for cultivating that sort of near invisible end of the food web, if we want to make our own starter, first, what is starter? What purpose does it serve in baking?
Okay, so starter is really a very simple formula. It's flour and water that is combined to create a medium for microbes to thrive, and those microbes are a combination of bacteria, lactobacillic bacteria, but also different strains of wild yeasts. And those two things, the bacteria and the yeast, live together in symbiosis. The bacteria create a very acidic environment where a lot of the bad guys or the microbes that spoil our food cannot thrive. But the yeast that we cultivate to leaven our bread can. So it's a really fascinating sort of mix. And really, by just activating the starches in flour using water and helping that process of converting them into sugars allows the microbes to be able to feed, and thus they give off carbon dioxide, and that leavens our bread.
Mm-hmm.
However, the bacteria, they also do this wonderful thing for us, which is the pre-digestion component.
Right.
That you don't get with something like commercial yeast. So that's what really differentiates sourdough in terms of the digestive component, but also in terms of the flavor component. Those lactic acid bacteria, they put off these sort of ethyl alcohols that are absolutely delicious.
Huh, interesting. Wow,
yeah.
So it starts there. And, you know, I was interested to see that you make your own starter because, of course, people I know have always, like, mail-ordered a packet of something or other and they started there, but you kind of have, is it a European-inspired, old-time kind of recipe that involves, like, raisins and water and flour? And so can you tell us a little bit about where does this come from? And you call it the mother, I think, yes?
Yeah, I call it the mother because it gives birth to so many different recipes in the book. And there are a lot of different ways that you can approach creating a sourdough culture. But I found for myself way back when I first started creating and working with sourdough that it was much easier to create what is referred to as a yeast water first. And that yeast water is composed of dried raisins, some honey, water, and some sugar, and it creates a sort of bubbling fermentation liquid that is then used to inoculate the flour and the water that you mix it up with.
Wow. So should we go through the steps? Dare we try to do that?
Sure.
Should we go through the steps? So I have these simple ingredients. I have some glass jars, I assume, yes? I probably need some glass or ceramic jars, yes?
Glass or ceramic is best. You have to remember that acidic culture is going to sort of eat away at anything that might be reactive, like copper or plastic.
Right. So I have my water, my sugar, honey, raisins. I think those were the things. Oh, and some flour. You said those were the ingredients. So where does the process begin, and how long does it take? Sort of how does this go? How does this go for us?
Mm-hmm. So depending on the season and the ambient temperature in your kitchen is going to influence how long it actually takes to create the initial starter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So for a warmer kitchen, it may take 5 to 7 days. For a kitchen that's much colder, it may take a bit longer. So those are something to remember, especially, you know, in the beginning when you're not used to dealing with a culture, you sort of stare at this mixture and you're like, is it going to actually work? So, you know, I always tell people, find a warm spot in your kitchen initially. Sometimes that can be the top of the refrigerator. Some people like to switch on the light in their oven, which creates some warmth, and store it there. The key is just to remember not to forget it.
Right, there you go. Like much of life, Sarah, the key is to remember not to forget.
Yeah, be mindful.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So
the first step is really to just mix up the, to dissolve the sugar and the honey in water. And then you combine that with the raisins. And I like to put it into a container where you can allow some air exchange. You have to remember that these microbes, they're living and breathing things, so they need to be able to take in the oxygen and give off carbon dioxide in order to thrive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So being able to either pop the lid and leave it loose or remove the rubber gasket and just sort of lightly screw on the top.
Okay.
That type of container is really what you're looking for.
No hermetically sealed containers, please.
Okay. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've dissolved those, yeah.
Yeah. And so you're going to give that a nice shake at least once a day, and that's to incorporate more air into the mixture. And hopefully, if you're lucky, after about 3 to 4 days, maybe 5 to 6, mm-hmm. you'll see some air bubbles.
Okay.
And you'll see those sort of rising to the surface of this mixture. And that's your first indication that you have signs of fermentation going on.
Okay.
And that's a really good thing. You'll smell the difference. You'll smell sort of an alcoholic presence.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's almost, you know, like making homemade hooch. although this is a really sweet hooch.
Okay.
So once it gets bubbling, that's when it's ready to inoculate your flour and your water. So you use it first to mix with your flour, and you let that sit overnight or about 8 hours. And you should see, after about 8 hours or in the morning, some bubbles in your mixture. And then you have to feed it again. You have to remember that these microbes are hungry, and they have to be tended to or fed often in order to keep them happy.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people should understand, and I will give all the exact proportions in the transcript on the website for people who are listening, but also they should know when we say the flour, we're not talking about the flour, X number of cups of flour to make a particular loaf of bread. We're talking about the flour to make this starter, yes?
Correct.
Right, okay, good, mm-hmm. good.
Yeah,
okay.
Correct. So this, once you get your flour and sort of hooch concoction going and bubbling, then all you have to do to maintain it is to give it equal amounts of water and more flour by weight of the starter. So if you end up, say, with 100 grams of starter mixture, then you always want to feed it with 100 grams of water and 100 grams of flour. And that provides the culture enough food in order to feed and grow and stay active and happy.
So I always hear with bakers, it doesn't take long. Expert bakers always start talking in grams, and that makes me want to say, we can't think about cups. I know you think it's funny, but we can't, like many of us think, we don't even know many of us who cook at home, uh-huh. you know, amateurish, we don't even know the difference between liquid measure and dry measure, let alone are we using a gram scale. But a scale is a really great thing, and they're not expensive, right? I mean, a scale is important, right?
It's so wonderful. You know, a lot of people think, oh, I have to be that exact? But it's more than just the science of baking. It actually cuts down on the mess in the kitchen.
It does. I've watched expert bakers who have this bowl, their bowl, on top of their scale, and they mm-hmm. are just measuring right into that bowl. And it's just getting,
correct.
You know, more and more and more. It's like, wow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
great.
So, you know, you don't have to clean as many dishes at the end of your baking session.
Yeah.
I mean, it really makes life so much easier. But it also, especially for beginning bakers, when you need sort of a baseline to hone your skills, it takes a lot of the guesswork out of baking. I mean, everyone I've ever met doesn't measure the same cup of flour.
Right.
It's always a little bit different. And especially when you're working with flours other than commercially bought flours, like stone ground local flours, it really helps to take the guesswork out of the weight of a cup.
Right.
Yeah.
So I didn't mean to interrupt. By now, this thing is bubbling over in Hungary, and we've been feeding it, and it's getting more and more. I think one starter you called Jabba the Hutt, in fact, which made me laugh, right?
Yeah. They, depending on what kind of flour you use to feed your starter, they take on vastly different personality characteristics.
Well.
And I always tell people it's really great if you can give your starter a name, because you will tend to be more attentive to it and think of it as something that you have to keep alive.
Right. You don't leave it in the oven with the electric light on and forget about it for 4 weeks.
Oh, gosh, I hope not.
No. So we have this bubbling live thing, and we've been feeding it, and we're measuring carefully. And then what happens? At what point is it ready to do service as a starter?
So a wonderful test to see if it's ready is to take a big heaping spoonful and drop it into a glass of water.
Oh.
If that spoonful floats, then you know that there's enough carbon dioxide trapped in the starter to be able to leaven your bread.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It's a really wonderful test. And that really, you know, that goes for a new starter as well as a starter that you've maintained for a while. I always tell people, you know, it sounds like a lot of work, but once you get a starter going, you can keep it in the refrigerator and feed it, you know, minimum of once a week. And then when you get ready to bake, pull it out, feed it a couple of times, get it going, and then perform that test again to make sure that it is happy and ready to leaven your, say, weekend loaf of bread that you want to bake.
So is this a forever thing, or does eventually the starter, the mother, kind of wear out and stop even with feeding and watering regularly and TLC mm-hmm. and being named and patted on the head? even with all that, does it finally, like, go kaput, or do you forever and ever? You know, I was just trying to understand that.
You know, people have maintained starter cultures for over 100 years. I mean, it's really amazing. As long as you are consistently feeding it with flour and water and keeping those microbial populations high, you should be able to maintain your starter infinitely.
Wow.
Now, you will notice that its behavior will change considering the season. So how hot or cold it is in your kitchen, but also the different types of flour you feed it. If you're using a stone ground flour that's been freshly milled, then that flour is going to have a lot more available foods to the microbes in your starter. So it's going to ferment a lot faster and also have a very different smell. And I always tell people, so you really engage all of your senses when you are maintaining a starter, because the smell will change, not just the appearance.
So it's so interesting. So we have this forever friend, this mother, this starter that we've made, and we're going to feed and care for it. And I think you say in the book that you like to keep from 150 to 300 grams of starter on hand at all times. You bake mm-hmm. a lot, so that's a good amount. Those of us who might bake less, we might only need half of that, but we need to keep refreshing it and feeding it and so forth, whatever the amount, yes?
Right, right. So a lot of people are what I would call a weekend baker,
mm-hmm.
and they really only need to keep about 50 to 75 grams in a small jar in their refrigerator at any one time. And that allows them to be able to feed and refresh it without having a lot of extra starter on hand.
Okay.
But if you do end up with a lot of extra starter, there are tons of wonderful recipes in sourdough in the book.
Yes.
That you can just incorporate it in, not as a leavening agent, but as just another ingredient.
So speaking of that, we have maybe, you know, 3 or 4 minutes left, and I wanted to just kind of peruse for people to get them hungry. You, again, owing to your botanical passions, a lot of your recipes have, like, plant names and flavors and so forth, like, there's not just a chocolate cake, but there's a chocolate chipotle kumquat cake, or a pear and buckwheat cake. So there's a sun-dried tomato shortbread and a beetroot chocolate cake. I know that things aren't in season right now, but what are the kinds of flavors that you're incorporating in recipes at the moment in your kitchen?
Right. So a lot of things I use right now are either ingredients that I've preserved earlier in the season.
Okay.
So like dried rose petals or dried fennel seeds or even lilac sugar, which I have a wonderful recipe for.
Lilac sugar. Interesting.
Yeah. It's wonderful with fresh fruits like blueberries.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I sort of look to ingredients that are kind of always in season. So like dried nuts and fruits, chocolate, those sorts of things.
There was a bread that was seeded turmeric and leek bread. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it had a color, a gorgeous golden color. Well, there's so much to choose from in the book, and I'm so appreciative of your taking me through how to create my own personal pet Jabba the Hutt over here in my kitchen. Sarah Owens, the author of Sourdough, Recipes for Rustic Fermented Breads, Sweets, Savories, and More. We're going to have a book giveaway, of course. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
You're welcome. And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. Subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on facebook.com/awaytogarden. Happy seed chopping, happy seed starting, happy baking meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.